Welcome to the reading of the Quad City Times for Friday, April 26th. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of people with print disabilities. Your readers today are Jim Hoffman, and my name is Rachel Thorson Mithelman. And here is Jim with our first story.
Thanks, Rachel. We start off with this story coming out of Northwest Iowa. This written by Dolly A. Butts of the Sioux City Journal. Missing trucker's body is found. No matter the weather or the occasion, Wall Lake trucker David Schultz always wore traditional cowboy boots. Schultz's brown Wrangler boots with blue on the soles is how the 53-year-old body was identified after it was found lying face up in a field roughly 1.5 miles from where his semi-tractor trailer loaded with hogs was discovered abandoned over 5 months ago. He always wore them in the summer and the winter. It didn't matter. He didn't wear work boots, just always cowboy boots and jeans, Sarah Schultz said of her husband, as she stood outside of the white, single-story Sac City Motel on Thursday morning, her shoulder-length, wavy, light brown hair blowing in the wind. He didn't like it when truck drivers would wear sweatpants and flip-flops. To him, that was just appalling. It's disgusting. He does not respect that. He feels like he's representing the trucking community. Schultz said she had felt relief and sorrow since she learned her husband's body had been discovered by a farmer in his freshly tilled field. The unidentified man found the body shortly before 2 p.m. Wednesday in the vicinity of the intersection of Union Avenue and 190th Street in rural Sac County, northeast of Sac City, according to the Iowa Division of Criminal Investigation. I'm glad we know where he is, said Schultz, who said her husband's body is at the state medical examiner's office and was being autopsied Thursday. There's still a lot of questions, you know. Things just don't make sense. Schultz, a married father of 10-year-old twin boys, vanished before Thanksgiving. He was last heard from in the early morning hours of November 21, according to the Lakeview Police Department. From what she understands, Schultz said her husband's body was found on its back, clad in a T-shirt, which was pulled up. She said law enforcement didn't show her a photo of the cowboy boots, but she said they were the same brand her husband always wore. He had underwear on, and I think his jeans were down. His cowboy boots were on, I think, she said. I know they identified him by the boots, because the last time he went and bought boots, he bought two pairs of the exact same ones. I gave the sheriff one of the newer boots to have its comparison. Jake Rowley of the United Cajun Navy said Schultz's body was found in the original 2-mile radius that he had been told law enforcement searched. He said the United Cajun Navy, which scoured more than 100,000 acres in and around Sac County, looked for Schultz, didn't search that particular area. Schultz added that she recalled a thermal imaging drone from the Iowa Department of Transportation flying over. That original area was just marked green out of the gate because, from my understanding, it had been searched by professionals, said Rowley, who said that raises a baffling question about whether Schultz's body was there the entire time or not. The Iowa DCI could not be reached by the Sioux City Journal on Thursday morning, and the Sac County Sheriff's Office referred the journal to the Iowa DCI. Neither Schultz's nor Raleigh have viewed the body. Schultz has trouble grasping how her husband's body wasn't just bones, given the length of time that has passed since his disappearance and the relatively mild winter Northwest Iowa experienced. I can't believe it wasn't just bones by now, knowing there's animals, vultures, coyotes, and what they made it sound like nothing made it sound, nothing was missing, it wasn't just bones, so I don't understand, she said. Schultz regularly posted updates on her Facebook page about her husband's case. She previously called his disappearance suspicious and said this is not something David would do. He would never leave. His family is his life. During a December 14th interview with the Journal, Schultz expressed frustration with local law enforcement and said she felt the case was more than small-town police can handle. When asked how she currently feels about how the investigation into her husband's disappearance was handled, Schultz said, I don't really want to talk about that. Schultz, who works as a safety coordinator for EVAPCO in Lakeview, said she learned her husband's body had been found from her boss. She said he tricked her into going for a car ride. Since it was such a nice day out, she got into his truck. As he drove, they talked about work stuff. I didn't understand it until we got to about my house, and he grabbed my hand and said, I know you've been through a lot this year. The sheriff called, and he wants to meet at your house to talk to you. So I knew, Schultz said, her voice quaking and her eyes filling with tears.
Also on the front page, interim admin approved. Merit agreement, including conditions, is okayed by an 8-2 vote. This is from the Davenport City Council and is written by Sarah Watson. Davenport Interim City Administrator Mallory Merritt will continue in her role until a new permanent administrator begins, the council determined in an 8-2 vote on an employment agreement with her on Wednesday. The City Council earlier this month failed to ratify a memorandum of understanding that laid out expectations and pay for Merritt in an interim administrator role. That memorandum was signed by 5 members of the City Council and the mayor in November, but did not go before the council for a public vote at the time. The council met in closed session a week ago and came to a new tentative agreement with Merritt, which appeared on this week's agenda for a vote. The new agreement keeps Merritt in her interim role until September 30th or a new permanent city administrator is named, whichever comes first, and allows her to return to her previous chief finance officer position once her interim role ends. The new agreement drops the previous memorandum's $50,000 bonus, but pays Merritt her base salary of $174,420 plus raises afforded to other non-bargaining and director-level employees, and pays her retroactively to November the differential of her salary and the previous city administrator's salary for the additional duties. That means for the retroactive months from November to April, she would be paid $37,458 on May 3rd. For the salary differential, Merritt would be paid $6,273 per month starting May 1st. The new agreement also included a provision that Merritt agreed she would not apply for the permanent city administrator role and would champion and promote the search for a new city administrator. She will also name an interim finance director by May 1st under the agreement. Another change was to how Merritt could be removed. Under the previous agreement, Merritt could be terminated only by the unanimous approval of the signees of her agreement, the council chairs, mayor, and mayor pro tem. The new agreement allows for the mayor or any two members of the city council to bring forward a resolution to end her appointment as interim city administrator, and her removal would require a two-thirds vote of the entire council. That's the same as for a permanent city administrator. Alderman Tim Kelly of the 5th Ward and Alderman Jade Burkholder of the 4th Ward voted against the agreement. Burkholder said she thought the council should have discussed items in the agreement in greater detail. Kelly said he thought that Merritt needs to get paid for sure, but wasn't sure that the city should pay her the previous city administrator's wage while she serves as interim. Some members of the public urged the council to vote against the agreement. Several, including Ezra Sidran, argued the city needed a fresh pair of eyes in the top staff role, untied to the previous city administrator and the decision to pay her $1.6 million for claims of harassment. Others, including former Alderwoman Judith Lee, questioned whether the conflict of interest provisions in the contract were sufficient for Merritt, whose spouse is the Director of Engineering and Capital Projects. At-large Alderman Jasmine Newton addressed concerns before the vote on the agreement. Newton said the City Council all had input on the agreement this go-round, and that she believed Merritt should be paid for the work she's done since November. "I was against a bonus. There were several council against a bonus, but she did perform a job from November to this date and will be continuing to perform a job," Newton said. "Say if a manager at your work quits and then you have to do that job, you're going to be expected to be paid what that position pays." Newton said what the city paid its administrator was toward the median of what other large cities in Iowa paid their administrators. Newton added that the page of procedures for contracts and projects initiated by her spouse was prepared in order to address any conflict or appearance of conflict of interest as much as possible. "I agree that's an issue, and I think she recognizes the same, which is why she's not applying for the position. And she made that clear, and that's actually in writing, so it's crystal clear to the public," Newton said. "The council did take steps to ensure we address the conflict as much as possible, which is why there's a couple pages worth of provisions meant to protect against any possible or apparent conflicts." To address concerns that other city officials were not paid for performing multiple jobs, Newton said, "When I look at things, I think two wrongs will never make a right. I'm looking at this, I'm trying to do the best that I can for the city. I think the council is trying to do the same thing with the information that we have in this moment. And that doesn't mean we're not going to look at other issues that have come before the council."
And our next, we turn to local news, and this concerns Scott County Sheriff. This is written by Caleb McCullough of the Quad City Times. "Lane is under investigation. Use of patrol car in parade may have broken campaign laws." Iowa's Campaign Ethics Board has launched an investigation into whether Scott County Sheriff Tim Lane's use of patrol cars during a parade last year was a violation of state campaign laws. The investigation stems from a complaint filed with the Ethics and Campaign Disclosure Board, alleging the sheriff violated the law by using patrol cars in a Bettendorf Halloween parade. Lane has denied that the event, which happened before he announced his reelection bid, was a campaign event. Iowa law generally prohibits the use of public resources, which includes money, facilities, and equipment, for political purposes. Law enforcement officials are allowed to wear their uniforms while campaigning, the board's executive director, Zach Goodrich, said at its April 18th meeting, but that is the extent of the public property they can use to campaign. Using patrol cars for your campaign in a parade is not permitted, and so it is an apparent violation that we need to investigate, Goodrich said. The Iowa Ethics and Campaign Disclosure Board voted unanimously during that meeting to investigate the complaint further. Lane said he did not. He did enter patrol cars in the Bettendorf Halloween parade last year, but he said it was not a campaign event and denied he violated any laws. The sheriff's office and myself were in the Bettendorf Halloween parade handing out candy to kids. The sheriff's office has participated in this event for many years and also assists with the uniform security for the event, Lane said in a written statement. This was a public relations event, not a campaign event. Lane announced his re-election campaign in January. Lane paid for the entry in the parade personally and not out of a campaign account or the sheriff's office funds, he said in an interview. Lane provided a copy of the complaint filed with the board, which alleged that his wife and children were at the parade wearing his campaign T-shirts. One photo attached to the complaint shows Lane with reserve deputies standing in front of a patrol car at the October 28th, 2023 parade. Another photo, which was posted on the Scott County Republicans Facebook page, appears to show Lane in front of a separate float of the same parade that says Vote Republican, alongside family members wearing Tim Lane campaign T-shirts. Lane suggested that the complaint came from the campaign of his Republican primary opponent, Chris Lay. Even though my Republican opponent denies involvement in the ethics complaint, the name of the person who filed the complaint is public and is in fact from his campaign, Lane said. Lay denied he had any involvement in making the complaint with the ethics board. The complaint was filed by Diana Danielson. Danielson has walked in parades in support of Lay, but he said she is not employed by his campaign and he did not direct her to file the complaint. He said only he, the committee chair and the committee treasurer, could speak on behalf of the campaign. The accusation by Tim Lane, this originated without our campaign, is once again misinformation levied against myself and our campaign to mislead the public, Lay said in an email. The ethics board has determined this is a complaint requiring further investigation, so we will have to wait for the completion of the investigative process and see what the findings are. Every individual has the right to due process, regardless of who they are, so we will have to let this process occur before any findings are provided. Lane, a Republican, has been the Scott County Sheriff since 2016. He is up for re-election this year and being challenged by Lay in the June 4th primary. Democrats Gordon Morse and Thomas Gibbs have also filed to run for the office. I expect to be exonerated in this, and I plan on putting cars in the Bettendorf Halloween parade again this year, Lane said.
Murder case versus Bay Hall moves on. This is by Tom Lowy. The Parkview man accused of the March murder of Taylor Escontrias was arraigned Thursday. Christopher Bahal is charged with first-degree murder and six other offenses for the March 13th killing of Escontrias in the Parkview apartment the couple shared. Judge Henry Latham ruled in the arraignment in writing Thursday, deciding the case can move forward because the trial information and testimony contained evidence which, if unexplained, is sufficient to warrant a conviction by a trial jury. The first-degree murder charge is a Class A felony and carries an automatic life sentence. Bahal also faces felony charges of assault while participating in a felony leading to serious injury, going armed with intent, and willful injury. He is charged with misdemeanors of domestic abuse, assault with intent to inflict serious injury, domestic assault, the display or use of a weapon and operating while under the influence. Investigators believe Bahal, age 30, used a bat, knife, and screwdriver to kill Escontrias, age 31, sometime between 8 p.m. on Wednesday, March 13th, and 1:47 a.m. Thursday, March 14th, in their apartment at 105 Crestview Drive. Ethan Rowling, a detective with the Scott County Sheriff's Office, provided testimony for Assistant Scott County Attorney Gil Carnegie during a March 23rd preliminary hearing. Rowling's testimony included statements he said Bahal made to deputies. Bahal initially told investigators he acted in self-defense, but later gave a different account, Rowling testified. Bahal's later statement included that the first thing he remembered was striking Escontrias with the bat, then finally stabbing her, saying he did so to put her out of her misery, Rowling said. Deputies found blood in several places in the apartment, and evidence indicates Escontrias tried to get away, Rowling told Traum. The autopsy indicated Escontrias had been stabbed and bludgeoned numerous times, Rowling testified. Investigators think she was stabbed with a screwdriver and knife. Authorities ruled the death a homicide but said it was not clear which wound killed her. During the preliminary hearing, Seth Harrington, who is Bahal's attorney, did not question Rowling, but argued the state had not met the burden required to charge his client with first-degree murder. Bahal has two domestic violence cases on his Scott County record, both involving the same woman, who was not Escontrias. One of the cases is pending, the other was dismissed. The most recent of the cases happened in January of 2023, according to court records. Bahal initially faced a charge of domestic abuse, assault, injury, or mental illness, first offense. The charge stems from Bahal's alleged acts on the night of January 8, 2023, at a residence in Davenport. Authorities accused him of punching the woman in the back of her head. He also picked her up under her arms and threw her down the metal steps outside of the residence, causing scrapes on her legs and one hand, according to court records. She refused treatment but did request a no-contact order, records show. In April of 2023, Bahal pleaded guilty to assault causing bodily injury as part of an agreement with the Scott County Attorney's Office. The no-contact order also was lifted at this time. He received a deferred judgment, but in May was accused of violating its terms by not completing a substance abuse evaluation. The court later gave him further time to comply with the condition of his probation. That case remained pending as of Thursday. The earlier case related to acts authorities accused Bahal of committing in January of 2021 at the same residence, records state. Bahal initially was charged with domestic abuse assault, first offense, but the case was later dismissed.
Thank you, Rachel. And we have an article here, written by Sarah Watson, Concerts to Kick Off Memorial Day Weekend. In this regards, the Big Nine Summer Concert Series in Davenport. A new riverfront concert series will bring musicians to parks and other venues along Davenport's 9 miles of riverfront. The Big Nine Summer Concert Series debuts Memorial Day weekend, May 25th, at Veterans Memorial Park with band Moonshine Run. It'll be the first of 9 concerts held along various locations on the Davenport Riverfront. The new concert series, hosted by the Riverfront Improvement Commission, the City of Davenport, and Common Chord, will replace the former Music on the River series. The series is produced in part through a grant from the Regional Development Authority, according to the city. This new programming model allows for the opportunity to showcase many of our local artists as well as small businesses, while also shining a light on different areas of our beautiful riverfront. Stephanie Bly, Riverfront Community Engagement Coordinator, said in a news release. By expanding our programming, we hope to reach a wider demographic of Davenport residents. There is truly something for everyone. See a detailed schedule and event updates at davenportiowa.com/riverfront or commoncordqc.org. And a listing of the nine events, we have Saturday, May 25th. They're kicking off at Veterans Memorial Park. The band is Moonshine Run. On Saturday, June 8th, at Quinlan Court, the band is Logan Springer and the Wonderfully Wild. On Saturday, June 15th, LeClaire Park, the band is Jerry Johnson Choir and the Voices. And on June 27th, Thursday, Ruby's Outdoor Stage, it's BYO Brass playing. And on Wednesday, July 3rd at LeClaire Park, the band is Identity Crisis. On Saturday, July 13th, Village of East Davenport, the band is Fair Warning. On Saturday, July 20th, The Last Picture House, the band is For Those About to Yacht. And on Saturday, August 10th at the Freight House, the band is Germ Theory. And finally, on Saturday, August 31st on Credit Island, the band is Quad City Rock Academy, Beaker Brothers Band, and Einstein's Sister.
I didn't know Einstein had a sister. Just a short article about some scholarships awarded. Area students receive credit union scholarships. The Iowa Credit Union Foundation awarded a record-breaking $46,000 to 24 students across the state for its annual Warren A. Morrill Memorial Scholarship Pledge, including two Quad City students. Because of an influx of applicants, the organization awarded 8 more high school scholarships and 4 more post-high school scholarships than in previous years. This year's local Warren A. Morrill Scholarship recipients include Bettendorf High School senior Kimbri Callahan, a member of Dutrac Community Credit Union, $2,000 scholarship; North Scott High School senior Zachary McMillan, a member of IH Mississippi Valley Credit Union, a scholarship of $2,000. Davenport West High School senior Landon Magawa, a member of RIA Federal Credit Union, a scholarship of $1,000. And Central DeWitt High School senior Emma Holmes, a member of First Gateway Credit Union, a scholarship of $1,500. Applicants completed an online entry form and answered an essay question on the meaning of community and how they serve their community. Last year, the program awarded $23,000 to 12 high school and post-high school students pursuing further education. It's time to turn to a reminder that you're listening to the Quad City Times on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Time to turn to the obituaries in today's paper. There are no pendings listed, so two obituaries will each read one of them. The first one from Davenport for Richard Dick Snyder. Funeral services and mass of Christian burial for Richard or Dick Snyder, age 71 of Davenport, will be held at 11 a.m. on Saturday, April 27th, at Holy Family Catholic Church in Davenport. Burial will be private. Memorials may be made to the church. Mr. Snyder passed away Saturday, April 20th at Genesis East Davenport with his family present. The Halligan McCabe DeVries Funeral Home of Davenport is assisting the family. Richard Walter Snyder was born July 2, 1952 in Davenport, a son of Walter and Helen Seville Snyder. He graduated from Assumption High School, class of 1971. A lifelong resident of Davenport, a devout Catholic and a member of Holy Family Church, Dick was a beloved member of his communities. He was an incredibly hard worker and a grocery store utility clerk, handling everything from bagging groceries to accepting deliveries. He worked for over 30 years for Eagle Food Stores and another 15 years for Schnucks. Born with significant medical issues, Dick overcame all obstacles and rarely ever missed a day of work. Dick was a passionate fan of the St. Louis Cardinals, and he enjoyed watching classic sitcoms. Most of all, Dick deeply loved his family, including his cousins, nieces, nephews, and grandnieces and nephews, as his vast collection of photographs attests. Dick never missed an opportunity to send a handwritten Christmas or birthday card. Dick truly was one of a kind and will be deeply missed. Survivors include his sister-in-law, Deborah Snyder of Rock Island, niece and nephews, Thomas, spouse Lisa Snyder of Denver, Colorado, Martin Snyder of Chicago, Julie, spouse Jeff Snyder of Maplewood, New Jersey, Stephen, Miranda, spouse Miranda Wilson of Franklin, Tennessee, Bradley Wilson of Rock Island, Grant, spouse Sudepti Snyder of Chicago, and several cousins. He was preceded in death by his parents and brothers, William and Thomas. Online remembrances may be expressed at the hmdfuneralhome.com website.
And we have Brenda Joanne Lane Reynolds, 62, of Newton, died Wednesday, April 17, 2024. A celebration of life will be held from 12 o'clock to 3 o'clock p.m. Saturday, May 18, 2024, at the Wallace Family Funeral Home and Crematory in Newton. Memorials to Jasper County Conservation or the Iowa DNR can be left at the funeral home. Brenda, the daughter of Richard and Georgia Heller Lane, was born September 6, 1961 in Cedar Rapids. She grew up in Parkview/Eldridge and attended North Scott High School. She worked as a floral designer for Hy-Vee for 12 years before becoming a dietary aid manager at Nelson Manor and Park Center. She most recently had been working as a cleaner for Suncrest Village. Brenda was united in marriage with Herbert Reynolds on September 19, 1998, in Newton. Brenda was a lover of nature. She and Herb spent many hours together fishing and mushroom hunting. She also enjoyed growing plants, gardening, keeping her yard dandelion-free, and making her surroundings more beautiful. Brenda was also an animal whisperer, easily bonding with all sorts of creatures. She raised her pet squirrel, Sammy, from the time she found him as an injured baby. She also made sure the outside squirrels were taken care of, regularly putting peanut butter sandwiches out for them. Brenda had a great sense of humor, often making silly comments to her friends and family. She also enjoyed spoiling her grandchildren, making sure they never went home hungry when they visited. Brenda is survived by her daughter, Tracy, spouse Brandon Bergfeld of Newton, her grandchildren, Dawson Abel and Kai Bergfeld, both of Newton, her father, Richard Lane of Parkview, her siblings, James Lane of Newton and Jerry Lynn Jackson of Davenport, many nieces and nephews, and many friends who loved her and who she loved, especially those who had been taking care of her. Brenda was preceded in death by her mother, Georgia Lane, husband, Herb Reynolds, stepson, Tim Reynolds, aunt, Jenny McCoy, and nephews, Travis, Abel, and James Connell III.
And before we leave obituaries, there is also a short article about the death of the Reverend Cecil Williams, pastor who turned church into a refuge for many, dies. It's accompanied by a photograph of Dianne Feinstein, California Assembly Speaker Willie Brown, and the Reverend Cecil Williams of Glide Memorial, holding hands during a Martin Luther King Jr. Day march back in the 80s. The Reverend Cecil Williams, who with his late wife turned Glide Church in San Francisco into a world-renowned haven for people suffering from poverty and homelessness and living on the margins, has died. He was 94. Williams and his wife, Janice Marikitami, who passed away in 2021, appeared in Will Smith's film, The Pursuit of Happiness, which was based on the life of a homeless father and son who once found help at Glide Memorial Church. Williams died Monday at his home in San Francisco, surrounded by friends and family, Glide said in a statement. A cause of death was not given. An advocate for civil rights and social justice, Williams' work drew the attention of celebrities, politicians, and businessmen, including Warren Buffett, who for years helped Williams raise money for the church through an auction for a private lunch with the hedge fund manager. Maya Angelou, Isabel Allende, Bono, Oprah Winfrey, and Bill Clinton were among the celebrities who once attended services at Glide. Williams' focus always remained on helping the poor. He told the San Francisco Chronicle in a 2013 interview, "I would have to be with people I understand, and it's the poor. I'm with them wherever they are." Born and raised in the segregated West Texas town of San Angelo, Williams moved to San Francisco in 1963 to become the pastor at what was then called Glide Memorial United Methodist Church, a house of worship with dwindling parishioners in the heart of the city's largely impoverished Tenderloin district. Williams and Marikitami transformed the church with Sunday services that included a jazz band and a gospel choir. The church eventually amassed 10,000 members, becoming the largest Methodist church in Northern California and one of the largest in the nation. They also put the church's sermons into action, and through the Glide Foundation started several community outreach programs that have served thousands of San Franciscans for over six decades. And now it's time to turn to the opinion page, and here is Jim with the first piece from that page.
Thank you, Rachel. Border crisis solution. Forget Biden and Speaker Johnson. This written by Gary Franks, and he served three terms as U.S. Representative for Connecticut's 5th District, and his column is syndicated by Tribune Content Agency. It is becoming increasingly obvious that we are turning to the wrong people to solve our invasion problem at our southern border. President Joe Biden, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, and the Democrats have little to zero interest in stopping the border invasion. And unfortunately, the competency level of some Republicans is suspect, while there are too many good Republicans leaving Congress. The result? We spend trillions of dollars on intelligence, homeland, and national defense to protect America from the bad guys. Yet we allow millions of folks, thousands of them on the terrorist watch list, and known criminals, yes, true bad guys, to simply walk across our borders unimpeded. But there is someone who has claimed he could fix the problem. His name is Mexico's President Andrés Manuel López Obrador. In a March interview on CBS 60 Minutes, he gave what I would call his peaceful terms of surrender for the United States. Sounds like extortion, but you can decide for yourselves. He called on the United States to commit $20 billion a year to poor countries in Latin America and the Caribbean, lift sanctions on Venezuela, end the Cuban embargo, and legalize millions of law-abiding Mexicans living in the United States. Only then, he said, he would work to stop the flow of migrants, who I believe have been weaponized to draw upon our precious resources that we already must borrow money to pay for. If we do not want to embrace Mexico's demands or negotiate something better for the United States, we should treat them like the frenemies to America that they truly have been over the decades. I wonder what former presidents like Reagan, Eisenhower, H.W. Bush, or even Truman would do. One thing for sure, those military-minded presidents would not blame the other political party for not doing its job to protect America. They would follow the Constitution, which says the commander-in-chief must protect each state from an invasion, and they would do something. Doing nothing would not be an option, which Biden's failed administration has opted for. Following a vote in the House over the weekend to pass on $95 billion in aid to other countries in our defense industrial base, Democrat members of Congress waved celebratory flags in the chamber, but they were not American flags. The money that we technically do not have and will be added to our deficit spending, which is not financially sustainable, is not going to Americans. America has failed to protect its borders while helping other countries protect theirs. On a plane before liftoff, the flight attendant instructs everyone that in the case of emergency, they should put on their oxygen mask first before assisting anyone else, even their children. Let us be clear, the issue here is not about foreign aid and support for Israel's security, humanitarian aid for the people of Gaza, support against a potential Chinese invasion of Taiwan, or military support for Ukraine. Assistance to our allies and for democracies around the world is vital to our national interests. Will the money we send fuel the fire for protracted wars or protect our allies from destruction? I believe the latter will prove to be true. Regardless, if we do not better manage these affairs, we will be right back here in a few months looking at worse scenarios. The 3-year-plus border crisis at the Mexican border is an invasion of America. Most Americans concur. Let us understand its magnitude. First, we must comprehend the fact that in the 21st century, we have new weapons, bows and arrows, guns, bombs, chemical weapons, etc. These have all been replaced to a degree using computers, the internet, cyberspace, sanctions, embargoes, and yes, the use of massive numbers of migrants who are being weaponized. All of the above can destroy a society. The volume of people crossing our border equals D-Day type of invasion for every month of the Biden administration. And what about House Speaker Mike Johnson? When the majority of your conference members do not vote with you, then you are not by definition the leader of the conference. When you tell your Republican conference and the American people while standing at the Mexican border that you will not allow funding to go to other countries before the border invasion is addressed, but then you do the opposite, you must resign unless you cannot seamlessly be replaced. Yes, I do love gymnastics, but not when it involves politicians. Speaker Johnson's flip on this issue would earn him a gold medal at the Olympics. To walk into a negotiation with the Democrats wearing a suit and tie and then leave it without your tie, jacket, or shirt, well, that's not how negotiations should go. The speaker won none of the GOP's priorities on the border. Biden can help Speaker Johnson in return for Johnson's help. Biden can return America to the policies of former presidents Donald Trump or Barack Obama regarding the border and send a significant number of troops to protect it. Biden can use executive orders to help solve the problem. Unless Biden saves Johnson, America needs a new Speaker of the House. Note, to do so, however, the following must be followed and assured. Whoever can gain the majority of the Republican conference should receive unanimous Republican support on the House floor. This is change without chaos and without the help of the Democrats. If every member of the Republican conference cannot make that basic commitment, then keeping Johnson as Speaker is the only option until January 2025. Will someone at least give the Mexican president a call? If he can solve our border crisis, we should do what we can do to make that happen using carrots or sticks.
And Tom Martin writes, who is the executive editor of the Quad City Times, we're reaching out to journalism students and legislative reviews are coming. This newsroom boasts two Daily Iowan executive editors in the past 4 years. Sarah Watson and Caleb McAuliffe are among the many talented journalists working for the Quad City Times. I saw their names on a plaque of former editors at the Daily Iowan when I visited the School of Journalism and Mass Communication in Iowa City on Tuesday. The Daily Iowan is a great college newspaper and regularly wins Pacemaker Awards, the top college newspaper award for excellence, and plenty of awards in the Iowa Newspaper Association as well. Another item I saw on the walls of the Daily Iowan Tuesday was a plaque memorializing Steve Batterson, who died June 27, 2023. A University of Iowa graduate, Steve was a sports reporter for the Quad City Times for 38 years. He served for 19 years on the Student Publications, Inc. Board of Trustees. We thought of Steve often as Caitlin Clark and the Iowa Hawkeyes women's basketball team put together an historic season. We appreciate Daily Iowan publisher Jason Brummond and the staff at the Daily Iowan commemorating Steve. The reason I was visiting Brummond and Michelle Silman, who coordinates internships at the J School, was to keep open the pathway between Iowa journalism students and the Quad City Times for internships and careers. The University of Iowa is where I got my bachelor's degree. We're not stopping with Iowa, however. I will speak with student journalists at Knox College on Monday, April 29th, and at Augustana College on May 6th. I was advisor of the student newspaper at Knox College in Galesburg for 11 years and annually competed against the Augustana Observer, which for a time was advised by my late friend and colleague Jim Dyer, who later taught at Knox. I'm open to visit journalists in the classroom. Send me an invitation to tmartin@qctimes.com. I'm not the only one in the newsroom visiting schools. This week, Sarah was one of 13 speakers at the Empower Her Leadership Summit at Central DeWitt High School. National Honor Society students attended from Central DeWitt, Comanche, and Calamus Wheatland and asked questions about journalism and women in leadership. The Iowa State House session has concluded. Do you want to know what your state representative and senator did during the term? We'll have that for you. Our State House reporter, Caleb McAuliffe, will put together reviews of each legislator from the Quad Cities area. The reviews will list key votes and bills sponsored for each legislator, along with their opinions on successes and failures of the sessions. In the coming weeks, be on the lookout for reviews for Cindy Winkler, Democrat of Davenport, Scott Webster, Republican of Bettendorf, Carrie Gruenhagen, Republican of Walcott, Chris Conoyer, Republican of LeClaire, Ken Croken, Democrat of Davenport, Monica Kurth, Democrat of Davenport, Mike Vondran, Republican of Davenport, Gary Marr, Moore, Republican of Bettendorf, Luana Stoltenberg, Republican of Davenport, and Norlin Mumsen, Republican of DeWitt. And finally, Teacher Appreciation Week is May 6th through 10. Last week, I invited readers to send in a blurb about a favorite teacher by May 1st. Unfortunately, we received none. We will publish responses if you send them. Include your name and current town or city of residence and follow this format. Your name, your city of residence, your favorite teacher, what class and where, and what made this teacher stand out. Email your favorite teacher blurb using that format to newsroom@qctimes.com or press@qconline.com. Put favorite teacher in the subject line, and we'll publish them during Teacher Appreciation Week.
And turning to sports, we have the sports events that you can view, tune into on the air. Today, beginning with Australian rules football on FS2 at 1:30, it's Carlton versus Geelong. Auto racing, if that interests you, the ARCA series from Dover on FS1 at 6 o'clock this evening. The college baseball games, Big Ten Network has a couple of them. At 4 o'clock, Illinois at Maryland, and then at 7 o'clock, Purdue at Northwestern, and the Southeast Conference Network, Florida at Arkansas at 7 o'clock. College women's beach volleyball at 11 a.m., the Pac-12 semifinal on the Pac-12 Network, and then at 12:45 and 3 on that same network, the Pac-12 Contenders Bracket Semifinals. West Coast Championship at 3:30 on ESPNU. And at 6 o'clock, the Pac-12 Championship, Pac-12 Network. We have college softball, a couple games. We have at 5 o'clock, Auburn at Mississippi, Southeast Conference Network, and at 10 o'clock, Stanford at Washington on the Pac-12 Network. For horse racing, at 12 and 3 p.m. today, the New York Racing Association, America's Day at the Races on FS2. Major League Baseball games on today. At noon, Kansas City at Detroit on Major League Baseball Network. The Cubs at 6:10 play at Boston in Marquee. At 6:10 also on Apple TV Plus, the Cardinals at the Mets. And at 6:40 on Apple TV Plus, Tampa Bay at Chicago White Sox. And at 7, the Yankees play at Milwaukee Brewers on Major League Baseball Network. The NBA is in their playoffs, and so 4:30, Eastern Conference Game 3, Milwaukee at Indiana is on ESPN. At 7, the Western Conference Game 3, the LA Clippers at Dallas, ESPN. And at 9:30 this evening, Western Conference Game 3, Minnesota at Phoenix, ESPN. The NFL draft rounds 2 and 3 continue at 6 o'clock on ABC, ESPN. The hockey playoffs are in session. Eastern Conference Game 3, Rangers at Washington on TNT. 6:30, Western Conference Game 3, Vancouver at Nashville, TBS. At 9, Western Conference Game 3, Winnipeg at Colorado on TNT. And at 9:30, Western Conference Game 3, Edmonton is at Los Angeles, TBS. And then finally, women's volleyball on CBS Sports Network at 8:30, pro volleyball game, Grand Rapids at Omaha.
Thanks, Jim, and we have like 2 minutes, so this little article. Iowa State and Kansas State will play their 2025 season opener in Ireland at the Aer Lingus College Football Classic. The Cyclones and Wildcats will close the 2024 regular season in Ames on November 24th and meet again on August 23rd, 2025 at Aviva Stadium in Dublin. The fourth annual game in Ireland, announced Wednesday, marks the first time ISU and K-State have met in a season opener, and a third time they've squared off at a neutral site. They played at Arrowhead Stadium in Kansas City, Missouri in 2009 and 2010. The opportunity for our student athletes, coaches, staff, alumni, and fans to visit one of the world's top travel destinations and to showcase our football program and brand on a global stage was one we could not pass up, K-State Athletic Director Gene Taylor said. Iowa State will be playing outside the United States for the first time. ISU coach Matt Campbell said this is a tremendous opportunity for the Big 12 Conference to play one of its classic rivalries on a global stage while showcasing our university and its football program. We are honored that Aer Lingus selected the Cyclones to participate in this prestigious game. That brings us to the end of the Quad City Times for today. My name is Rachel Mithelman, and my partner at the microphone has been Jim Hoffman. You can listen to IRIS programs on any computer or smart device at any time at iowaradioreading.org. And thank you for listening to IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.